You're listening to Retronauts, a part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows like us at podcast.hyperx.com. Content warning. This episode of Retronauts is a little saltier than usual, so proceed with caution.
This week in Retronauts, we're going to the happiest place on Earth, Coney Island! Welcome to Retronauts. We are here and we are talking about the Warriors. This is a Patreon request episode. Thank you very much to Alan Berry who requested this topic. And it's, at first glance, you're kind of like, the Warriors, that was a movie, right? Yes, it was a movie. It continues to be a movie. It's a let's say, a cult popular movie. But I think it had a lot of influence in the sphere of video games. And of course, it was a video game. But we'll get to that topic. Let's talk to our guests because we've got three wonderful people here joining me. Oh, I'm Diamond Fight, by the way. Hello. And let's start with a previous guest who's been in Japan, who's here in Japan with me.
Well, not with you, but yes. I'm in Japan. Hi, this is James Eldon, and I can dig it.
Yes. And how about we have two guests joining us from the state of California?
This is true. I'm Michael Raparez. Longtime Retronauts listeners might know me from years ago. I was on a few episodes with Bob and Jeremy, but I run a show called Video Game Apocalypse that you can find at videogameapocalypse.com.
And I'm Diana Goodman from 302010, where we look at movies and TV and music 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago. We started too early to talk about the Warriors, and that's not fair.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, that's part of why I built in, like, we do a classic corner of things that are, mm-hmm. like, more than 30 years ago, entirely so I could just cover stuff that I like.
always worthwhile, because, yes, thanks. So thank you very much, Michael and Diana and James. Thank you so much, because this is, you know, it's a movie about gangs. We gotta get a gang here to talk about the gang movie, right? I can't just do this one myself. So I guess the first thing we should always do in a topic like this is just share our personal histories with the Warriors, because I think everyone here might have been alive when the movie opened, but certainly far too young to see it. No, not you, James. Too young.
I was off by about 5 months.
Okay. But in any case, we were all too young to see it in the theaters. So yeah. I'm very curious how we all discovered. Let's start with you, Michael.
I guess I would have been old enough to see it in theaters, but I would have been like the crying baby that and people wonder why their parents bring them there in the first place. I think I saw it with you.
Yeah, I think we watched
for the first
it
time.
Together.
Yeah, as an adult.
And I'd seen it probably as a teenager. And I don't know how it came up. It came up, so we watched it.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that like I didn't see until I was in my 20s or 30s. And like along with Rambo, Escape from New York, and a few others. What was the Streets of Fire, where I watch it and it's like, oh, this is where all the video games and anime I grew up with came from. This was the template. I got it now.
Absolutely. And James, did your father show you this movie?
Yes. Yeah, so people, I have my own podcast. I forgot to mention Cinema Oblivia. We talk about old movies. And I have mentioned my dad a lot on that because he was instrumental in my movie development in his negligence. And this was one that... Because when my dad was divorced, he would just get movies. We had a video store. He owned a video store. And he would just grab movies for me, who at the time I was probably 6, and my brother, who was like 9, to watch. And that's how I saw The Thing, Aliens, Beverly Hills Cop.
Nice.
He took me to see Dead Heat in the theater. You know, normal stuff. And so we watched... I know I watched this movie when I was probably 6 years old with my brother. And... I didn't get it at the time, other than it was cool, and we loved it. It's one of the very, very, very few things my brother and I have in common, and from there, I have rewatched the film countless times. And as I've gotten older, I've enjoyed it on more levels. Like as a kid, it was just a cool movie, and when I was a teenager, it's like, yeah, fuck the man. And then when I went to film school and shit, I was like, wow, this is like a real movie that is like saying things and is filmed in a remarkable way and is kind of an artistic achievement. And fuck the man. So yeah, it's one of my all-time favorite movies. I have the soundtrack in multiple formats. I have the game, everything about it. I'm a huge fan of this movie.
Beautiful.
Probably top five for me. Top five movies of all time.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Mm-hmm. As for me, I remember coming across this in a weird way because I heard about it from friends. This is, you know, sort of in the pre-internet days, people would just talk about movies and they saw a movie somewhere and they didn't remember the title, but they knew it was like a bunch of gangs got together and this guy gets up and he's like, "Can you dig it? Can you dig it?" And just, I hear all these things about the movie, but like, what is this movie? What is it called? And so it wasn't until probably, you know, like early IMDb days but still video stores were open kind of situation where I could actually track it down, find the movie and rent it and watch it. And I remember really enjoying it. And then it just sort of, I kind of forgot about it for a while. And then I thought about it again when it became a video game. It's like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Just make a game out of this movie that clearly influenced people who made games. And, reviewing it again, for this podcast, I really had a good time watching it because it's also, you know, as we're going to get in discussion, it's an extremely New York movie. They filmed this movie on the streets of New York, underneath New York, and that really comes across. And it's a portrait of New York from a very different time. You know, I grew up, I should say, for those who don't know, I am from New York. So I grew up at I grew up during a time when New York was getting over some really hard times, and we'll talk about that. But, you know, to see this movie sort of reflects kind of a hint of the subway that I first rode, you know, when I was riding around, you know, when I first went to New York and rode the subway, like the subway cars were covered in graffiti. Like that was my first memory of the subway. Like these giant machines just covered in paint and just illegible. But like, this means something to somebody. What does this mean? You know? So,
yeah, I think The Warriors is a classic filthy New York movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it's up there with French Connection and Taking a Pelham 1-2-3.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like, this is the New York that doesn't exist anymore. Thanks, Giuliani.
Yeah, it's for me, my filthy New York movies are Pelham 1-2-3, this, and Basket Case. If you want to see the absolute, not to get off topic, the absolute filthiest New York in the world, watch Basket Case. At Times Square is like, you want to clean your house after watching that movie. But yeah, this is great filthy New York. It's like, yeah, you might get killed walking down the street, but it's so cool.
But think of the art being made.
But you can go to a punk show, you can see the birth of punk hip hop and the best era of disco, and almost get mugged or murdered. You know, you got to take the good and the bad.
Yeah, you might get in a cab and Scorsese's there ranting about shooting his wife in the face. Good times, man.
Oh, he's
good
not saying face in the movie.
He does not say face. does not say man either.
No. That Scorsese does not exist anymore. Thank goodness.
No.
So actually, we should probably touch upon that because I know, Diana, you're from Philadelphia and James, you're from Ohio, and I don't know where
I'm
from.
Toledo.
So, what is your New York history? Because I think that's relevant to the topic. Who's been to New York? When did you go to New York?
Oh gosh, we went up to New York a couple times when I was a kid, and then we moved to California, and so most of my gritty city memories are going back to Philly to visit all the friends, and you know, getting into fights on the basketball court, and my aunt getting mad.
Yeah,
and, you know. My mom getting mad, sending me to California again.
Yeah.
But, you know, everyone's heard the story.
I grew up in Washington State. I've been to New York twice. First time in like 2004, I think, to visit a friend who lived in Brooklyn. And got to see some grimy-ass subway stations. But I was immediately impressed by, like, I think I understand the New York mindset now. Why the stereotype is that New Yorkers, especially in Manhattan, have this type A personality, because you can get anywhere in this city in like 5 minutes and you get so impatient if anything holds that up for any amount of time.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. I'm also a quick walker. So it's like I'm walking around and like if you are in my way, like you better be bleeding. because I'm not, I've got no patience for you. Just please.
Are you going to tell them that you're walking there? Hey,
it's in my head.
I'm walking here.
It's in my head.
You say it like that, like in the movie. Hey, I'm walking here.
The second time I went, it was to visit Rockstar Games. So I stayed at a nice hotel and didn't get to see as much of the city as I would have liked. But
Rockstar, that's relevant.
Yeah.
Hey.
I've only been to New York, I think, twice, not including airport layovers. I went there once to see New Order, and that was like 10 years ago. And then I went since I've moved to Japan, and that's about 8 years ago. And I mean, New York's fine, but like for me now, it's very like, you know, when the first time I went to New York, I was sad. I wasn't almost mud and I couldn't go to a punk show. So like, aww. this is the New York in my head that I've always wanted to be to, and it's gone. And you know, if you go to New York, it's great. Go to Times Square. It's clean. It's Disney as hell, but it's worth going once, you know, to see it. Yeah. And the museums are fantastic. And if you can go to a good concert in the city, go to a good concert in the city. You know, that's what I think of. When I think of New York, I think of concerts and museums now. Mm. Not gangs and violence and graffiti.
Yeah. There's still South Philadelphia, most of Baltimore. Like, you want that experience. It's out there.
I mean, I lived in Pittsburgh, I lived in Pittsburgh for a decade, and it's not super, I mean, it's grimy from the pollution, but it's not like, if you want the dangerous city experience, there are areas there too. And you know, Toledo is now my hometown. It's now the 30th deadliest city in America. So hey,
wow, so something to aspire to. What's 29?
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Anyway, so I mean, in Pittsburgh, like, what was your gang then? I mean, what was your aesthetic?
They have one. Well, the Pittsburgh. I mean, you'd think it'd be black and yellow, but it's not. I think Pittsburgh just has Bloods and Crips. You know,
aww.
Toledo in the 90s had a pretty big Blood and Crip problem too. You know, so you know the mainstays.
I really want like a mining themed Pittsburgh gang with, you know, like the miners' helmets with the light on them, and they choke you with a terrible towel.
A Pittsburgh themed gang would dress like the Steelers and call themselves the Yinzers. I would imagine. We're gonna kick your ass in that. Anyway, that's enough Pittsburghese.
Yeah,
sorry.
They spend their weekends hanging around the mall, eyeing zombies.
Yeah, but and then they get those gigantic sandwiches with the fries in them. Yes, and then smash talk the Eagles. You know, but, yeah.
it is pronounced Eagles, technically.
And the Stillers. Anyway, we're way off topic now.
It's all right. It's urban. It's urban. It's urban talk. We're on brand. Mm-hmm. We're on brand.
Hey guys, Brandon, Vin.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Joe,
you see this thing here? Could you tell me if it's good or not?
Well,
I'm gonna need an hour.
Yeah, at least.
Should I just wait over there, or you want me to come?
No.
Talk it out with you guys.
Yeah.
Cool. Come on, let's go. Podrid Review. We review things so you can do things. Every week on the HyperX Podcast Network.
Hello, listeners. As part of the HyperX Podcast Network, we're letting you know that this year is HyperX's 20th birthday. To celebrate, they're offering some great deals on their award-winning gaming gear. If you're in the market for a new headset, a new microphone, blue light blocking eyewear, or any number of other high-quality HyperX products, head on over to HyperX20.com to check out all the birthday deals. Once again, check out the HyperX 20th birthday sale over at HyperX.com.
So yes, The Warriors. It's a motion picture. It released in 1979, February 1979, and it is a product of the man Walter Hill. And I think Walter Hill is a man who really, he shouldn't need an introduction considering the long career he's made and the many influential movies he's made, but I feel like because he hasn't really had a influential work in decades. I think a lot of people these days might not know about Walter Hill, which is a shame because some of the movies he made.
Like Michael Mann gets a lot of the love that Walter Hill should get. Gritty crime drama, actor focused. Yeah.
And they're both super stylish. Like, yes. Michael Mann has a style to his work, and early Walter Hill, from, like, Hard Times to probably Streets of Fire, just oozes style. Yeah, he's one of my favorite directors of that era. Like, he has made some of my favorite movies. And, yeah, he always says every movie he makes is a Western, no matter what it is. Because it has a very simple story, good guys versus bad guys, you know. Which is ironic because both his Westerns suck. But, you know. Well, not all of them. One of Long Riders is good, but Geronimo and Wild Bill are not good movies. Oh. So, yeah. But anyway.
Does Last Man Standing count as a Western, or is that?
I was going to say, that's kind of a Western.
It's Yojimbo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess so. I haven't seen that since it came out. Is that good?
I don't have strong memories of it.
Yeah. What Walter Hill movies? Like, do you want to talk about his movies at all? Like, ones or what?
This is a video game podcast, so we definitely want to mention the fact that specifically Hard Times and Streets of Fire were called out by name as things that influenced people making games in the 80s and 90s, especially people at Capcom. There was a story. Yes. There was a story by the Final Fight from a Final Fight interview. We had a Final Fight episode about this on the podcast, and they literally had a bunch of TVs in the office, and their producer or the executive was like, here, we're making a movie about America. You got to watch these movies to get a feel of what America's like. And Hard Times and Streets of Fire were in that playlist. And, you know,
Hard Times. I wish America was that cool.
But of course, you know, Hard Times, literally in Japan, Hard Times is called Street Fighter. And there's that shot of, Charles Bronson fighting a guy in front of a tugboat, which is like, well, that's Street Fighter 2 right there. And of course, Streets of Fire has a lot of beat 'em up to it. And the hero's name is Cody. There's one of the enemies is wearing one of those weird plastic jumpsuits that William Dafoe was wearing. It's like, it's just, there's a lot of direct references to that thing. So I think, you know, the Warriors definitely, we'll get into this later, but I think the Warriors has a lot of also video game influence as well. But I think it's less explicit. Like, I think Hard Times and Streets of Fire are like, there's a lot of one-to-one stuff there. I think the Warriors is more like anyone who made a video game that involved gangs and fighting around, they probably wanted to at least invoke memories of the Warriors. But he's done it. He's a lot of stuff. I mean, 48 Hours was a huge hit. And I think that's a template for like the buddy cop movie, I would say, right? Like, that's just, you got, you know, two guys and one of them's wild and the other one's a little older and he's too old for this shit, you know, that kind of stuff. That's, you know, and that's what, like 5 years before Lethal Weapon? Like, that's early 80s, 48 Hours, right?
It's 82, and that's the movie that made Eddie Murphy's career before Beverly Hills Cop. Like, that movie, you watch that movie, like, yeah, you know, that dude's be famous. Yeah. I think it's hilarious that Walter Hill, like, through his films, is such a major influence on either directly or indirectly on video games at Capcom. Like, that is funny to me. And also, before he was a director, he wrote The Getaway by Peckinpah.
Oh.
And you see that in games too. So a lot of his work, and also he was a writer on Alien.
Right.
And he's not credited as a writer because they changed the script so much, he's a producer. But I used to joke that every game is either every game was either Aliens or Streets of Fire. Either you're fighting people on a street or you're fighting space aliens or both. So it is crazy to think just how much of an influence his early work is on games as a whole.
Sometimes direct, like any early brawler where it's like shirtless dude in a vest is fist fighting a bunch of people. Double Dragon, Renegade. It's like literally wears its influence on its lack of sleeves.
So, the Warriors. So Walter Hill was the director. He also co-wrote it with a man named David Schaber. And I think the only other really interesting to me Schaber script is Nighthawks, because it's also I think Warriors adjacent, in that you've got a lot of New York crime and you're in the subway a lot. Except this time it's Sylvester Stallone and Billy Dee Williams as a bunch of cops trying to hunt down a terrorist played by Rutger Hauer. So that's a movie I think that doesn't get enough respect these days. That's a
I've never seen that. I gotta watch that.
That's good times.
That's pretty good. It's one of those movies where people are like, oh wait, Sylvester Stallone can do other things, and then he like chose not to for 20 years. But he's good.
Yeah.
So we've got producer Lawrence Gordon. It's this huge name in the movie world. I think eventually he became the president of 20th Century Fox. He's touched so many films in film history. Andrew Laszlo, cinematographer. I definitely jumped at me here is that he did First Blood. So that's another movie that I think that looks looks fantastic. It's you just get all these wonderful shots of trees and mountains, and you really get the sense of just the Pacific Northwest is like a character in that movie. I love watching that movie and enjoying all the sights.
Yeah, Laszlo is an underrated cinematographer for a lot of movies. He did a one called Fun House of Tobe Hooper, which is not a good movie, but it looks great. And he also did Remo Williams, one of my favorites. And he does cities really well. Like First Blood's great because of all the nature, but I think that Andrew Laszlo, between this, Streets of Fire, and Remo Williams, like he does grime. Like urban grime, really well. He's like, we got to get these streets wet. I don't mean that in an X-rated way. Like we have to get these streets wet because it'll look great, and then we don't have to worry about continuity of weather. Also,
sorry, looking at his filmography, is that you think that's how he got the Newsies gig?
He went out on Newsies.
I appreciate hiring an old pro for something that's such a throwback. Sure.
Yeah, makes sense. Sorry, I don't want to step on your toes, Diamond, but I think it's hilarious that this movie's three producers are Lawrence Gordon, Frank Marshall, and Joel Silver, because like the combined filmographies is like billions of dollars.
Yeah, I mean, there's not many bigger names out there other than maybe like a Spielberg, but as far as like raw producer, like Joel Silver, Frank, like these guys are famous for being producers. I think anyone else who's a more famous producer probably also directed something or wrote something of note, like. These guys are most famous for being producers because they produced goddamn everything. I mean, Silver did Predator, Silver did The Matrix. Like, Silver's done it. We would be here all day. But yeah, giants.
Yeah, you combine got the producers of Predator, The Matrix, Die Hard, and Indiana Jones on one movie. And like, because Joel Silver started as an assistant for, I think, Gordon. And one of these guys, I forgot which one. And it's just, and then he worked with Walter Hill a lot, and then he left Walter Hill first, and then Lawrence Gordon did eventually after a few bombs. But yeah, they all started without Walter Hill, you would not have Joel Silver.
Hmm.
Like, oh, good. Yeah,
very,
Lord.
Very important to his career.
I think that's fair.
So without this movie, you would not have The Matrix, is what I'm saying.
That's so weird. Yeah, if we didn't have the beat 'em up movie about guys in silly outfits kicking the shit out of each other for 90 minutes. And we wouldn't have all these other movies.
Or Action Jackson. You know, a lot of other Joel Silver classics.
Action Jackson. Yeah. Hell yeah. 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 But yeah, it's... I mean, I'm happy to talk about this in this movie in particular with the eye towards video games because it seems so obvious, but that never occurred to me before. It's like, yeah, this is... You just got to run through a bunch of levels and each one has a theme. That's it. That's yep. And apparently that's an ancient Greek notion. Yeah, Xenophon invented video games.
I want to get back to that later. One more thing before I move on, though. I do want to mention the music, because I think it is the movie is definitely famous for its music. Mm. James, you seem to know a lot. Tell us about Barry, James.
My favorite musical Barry, maybe behind Barry Wright, above Barry from the Bee Gees. Barry Devorzin is a composer. He worked in like rock music back in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. But he really kind of hit his stride as a composer and did a lot of different stuff. I think his most famous work outside of the Warriors is probably the theme to SWAT.
That's good music.
Which is a banger.
Yeah.
He also did the theme to the music for Cooley House, is a great movie. And
oh, nice.
Rolling Thunder, which is a disgusting movie I love. And also Xanadu. The music that was not ELO was him, but he is all over this movie. He was one of the first composers to really combine rock and electronic and symphonic elements together. And you hear that in SWAT, obviously, and you hear it here. And I think his score is fantastic. It has a propulsive energy to it. It moves, and it's just so good. And the original songs are good too. Like, this has that my favorite Joe Walsh song in it. Like, Joe Walsh, the best Eagle, I think we can go with. Yeah, I mean,
I don't have a problem with that.
I thought it was Eagle.
Eagles.
Okay.
No, not the Eagles. The Eagles. And it has that great cover of Nowhere to Run. And it has a Desmond Child song on it. And Desmond Child, he wrote all of Bon Jovi's hits. And, like, Kiss and Rat. And every 80s band had a Desmond Child song. So, like, the soundtrack is stacked. Not just with the composer, but with everything else. And if you want to hear it, there are different vinyl reissues you can get, but if you can find the La La Land Records reissue that has the complete score on one CD and then the original soundtrack on another CD, and that's the best way to hear it. You know, if you get all the Warriors all the time.
Yeah, it is it's a very simple score, but yeah, propulsive is the good word for it. And it never steals attention away. It's always very complimentary of the action going on. You know, you don't really think about it as you're listening to it until you're like, oh, wait, let me stop and think. Gosh, this is working.
Yeah, and that opening theme is so good. And one of the reasons it's so good is because, like, he wrote it as, like, this nonstop, propulsive, like, super fast thing. And then Walter Hill's like, you can't hear the dialogue. But he's like, no, I can't slow it down. It's important. He's like, no, I'll cut it. And so then he changed the song to have those parts where it drops out and comes back. And when it comes back stronger each time. So instead of just being like a nonstop intense thing, it's something that builds to a peak, almost like, you know, like Don't Stop Believing or something. And I think it works really well for that scene. And it sets that opening scene just sets the tone of the film so well. And you would not have it without the music. Sorry, I love this. I love this quarter.
No, it's fine. Please tell us all this stuff. It's funny, as good as the music is, and I definitely, rewatching it recently, I definitely got caught in the music. Man, this music is really good. I also thought about the contrast. You know, this is New York in 1979. Like, hip hop is being born, you know, on the streets. You know, I think about that Netflix series, The Get Down. Like, you've got all this sort of musical revolution happening. It's not reflected in this movie at all. And that's okay, because the movie is great music, but it's almost like, I feel like if someone ever eventually does try to remake this movie, I feel like they're going to swing really hard into, like, sort of hip-hop or early rap or, like, you know, Grandmaster Flash, something like that. So I feel like it's a very different – the music is very different than what people were probably actually listening to on the streets necessarily at that time. But I think it's great that it has its own identity, and I feel like it holds up – it almost holds up better because it's, like, this unique feel to it, but it's almost – am I making any sense? I don't know.
It is. You're right, but it is important that this movie came out before Rapper's Delight.
Okay.
So this movie actually kind of predates the beginning of the commercial viability of hip-hop. It probably came out before Rapture, which was the first time, you know, I mean, that's Blondie, a white girl rapping, but it's still the first rap on a pop hit. So rap is definitely a thing on the streets with, like, Bambaataa and that stuff, but I think in 78, 79, it's not there yet to be in a film, you know. I think still, if you thought of, like, quote-unquote urban music, you'd still think of, like, Motown and Soul.
Yeah, well, we're at the point where rap and hip-hop start coming in because of some of the electronica and disco, and that sort of weird overlap of a really repetitive beat, and now I can rap over it.
Yeah.
That's kind of where it starts. So
yes.
Yeah. I'd love to hear someone freestyle over this.
Well, a lot of people have sampled the music. My favorite is...
Oh, I bet. Shoot,
There's a band called Pop Will Eat Itself, which is most well known for... That's where Clint Mansell came from, the composer.
Ooh.
And
they kind of started as, like, a British Beastie Boys. They have a song called Beaver Patrol. It's really funny. But they have a song called Can You Dig It? And you can imagine. And all it is Cyrus's speech and him saying, can you dig it? With the guys in the band just listing off the things they like. We like Run DMC, Alan Moore. No, like, let's drop name dropping all the shit they dig. It's dumb as rocks, but it's a great song.
So let's talk about the cast. And I think the cast of this movie is very interesting because considering how long and strong the legacy of this movie is, I feel like a lot of the actors kind of don't have much of a legacy. A few of them do. A few of them have had great careers. But a lot of them just kind of faded away. In some cases, this is their only film. And it's just kind of it's an interesting mix of superstar character actors and people who you just really never hear from anymore. I think it's debatable. Who do you think, if people watch this movie today, who do you think is the biggest name when you watch the movie today? Who do you think it is?
Mercedes Rule.
Mercedes Rule. I mean, she won an Oscar. There's no doubt about that.
She's an Oscar winner. Oscar winning cast. Yes.
I would think James Remar.
James
Remar, I think, would be like the most recognizable.
He's probably the guy who's worked the most, you know?
Yeah. A lot of people are like, oh, he was on Sex and the City.
Yep.
Oh, that's why I don't know him. Okay.
A lot fewer people would be like, oh, he was the replacement Raiden in Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Definitely one of the funniest roles, I think, on his career.
I think he's the most notable warrior, you know? Maybe Michael Beck as Swan, but I love Xanadu because, you know, stereotypes are true. So, like, I think that one. But I think the most famous cast member in the film is David Patrick Kelly, who plays Luther.
Hmm.
What? Two reasons. Yeah. One, he has the line that everyone quotes forever.
Yeah.
He's the one. He's the warriors come out and play guy. And he has so many iconics. Like, he's also in Commando. He's Sully.
Right.
Who Schwarzenegger promises that he'll kill last, but he lies. And he was in The Crow. He's great in The Crow. He has really small roles in the John Wick movies. He's the cleaner. He's in 48 Hours. He's in every Walter Hill film, I think, up to Streets. He's in a lot of Joel Silver films. Like, Joel Silver must have liked him. He's in Twin Peaks. He was in Malcolm X. He's in a few, he's in some David Lynch stuff. So, like, he's a huge character actor.
Damn minute. He's the brother of Ben, or not Ben. Yeah, Ben.
Yeah,
he's Jerry. Jerry to Ben.
That's right.
Owner of the Great Northern. Oh my God, I never put that together before.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
That's him. I also think of him a lot as, it's a very small role, but in the movie Flirting with Disaster.
Oh, I've never seen that.
It's the one where Ben Stiller's looking, trying to find his biological parents. And he plays a person who he thinks might be his dad. And he's like a truck driver. So it's a really small role, but it's just a very funny part. And he shows up and he's a truck driver and he's excited to meet his potential son. But of course, it turns out it's not really his son, but it's just a really, it's a thing I think about a lot. Small scene.
Yeah. But yeah, so many people in this movie have barely acted. Mm. Like Rembrandt, the guy played Rembrandt, he passed away from HIV complications young. Cochise, David Harris, he's only in some small stuff. Cowboy quit to be a photographer. Vermin, who has the big one, that's his line. That's I got the big one. Anyway, sorry. He quit to work in news, and then he quit to be a congressional aide. So, like, okay. he got the big one. And then there's my favorite story is Fox, Thomas G. Waits, who was not even credited. Because he argued with Walter Hill so much, and he's the one who gets killed. Then they weren't. He was supposed to be the lead, and they rewrote the movie to kill him, and then and then made Swan the lead. And he's Windows in The Thing, and he's in a few other movies. But he says it's his fault. He's to blame, not Walter Hill.
And it's such a weird scene too, because like his character wrestles with a cop, and then it's like you don't see his face anymore because it's not him. And then the cop just kind of throws him on the train tracks, and it's like, and then he's like right in front of the train, and he dies, and it's like, well, he's gone now.
And they never even ask what happened to him.
No, it's like nobody seems to notice that he's not here anymore, and he's like such an important character because we've gotten all this way without even explaining what the plot is. That he's in a way he's the MacGuffin. He's the witness to who actually shot Cyrus. You know, at the gigantic gang meeting, all the gangs get together. And they figure out, wait, we could totally just take over the city. There's way more of us than there are cops. And it's supposed to be, you know, a meeting with no violence, but then somebody shoots him. And the warriors get blamed. And now they got to run through everyone else's territory to get home.
Yes.
That's it. That's the plot. But he's the one who sees who actually did the shooting, and it never comes up again.
Because it's Luther.
Luther's the killer. Yeah. And like, that actor, Thomas G. Waits, was almost a big deal. Like, he had a lot of buzz early on, and he was offered this movie and The Wanderers, which became a big problem, I guess, during production.
Two gang movies
that begin with W. And so he was offered more money for The Wanderers, but he liked this movie more, so he took it. And I think alcohol put an issue in his life and kind of hurt his career. But yeah, it is weird that he's like, he is positioned as the main character. If you watch the movie knowing this, you're like, oh yeah, that is kind of like the movie just kind of changes. Like, and then, hey, it's the Swan Show. Thank God it's not Ajax. Ajax sucks, but yeah. And there's a DJ.
Yeah, you never see your face. Yes, it's Lynn Thigpen.
Let's all sing in praise of Lynn Thigpen.
I take it back. She's the most recognizable person in this movie for me.
And you never see her.
Yeah. But you know that voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, it's the chief.
Mm-hmm. I feel like she did a lot of PBS stuff, right? I feel like she might have also been on Square One or something else, right? Like, I have a lot of memories like that adjacent to like the Children's Sounds Television Workshop with her, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Cito did a lot of ABC stuff, ABC After School Specials.
Mm.
I know that. And Cito was in like a lot of TV and all kind. Like, she's one of she was like, hey, it's her.
Yeah, I remember her as the somewhat antagonistic mom in the Joe Clark movie with Morgan Freeman. I always forget the name of this movie.
Lean on Me.
Yeah, she's in that, and she's kind of like, she's a mom who's not happy with the principal, and so she's always like in his face about that. Mm.
I always remember her from L.A. Law because I was a weird kid.
Me too.
So I watched L.A. Law.
What? Didn't every 11-year-old? It was a popular show.
I was there. I was there when she fell down the elevator shaft.
That wasn't her. But
that was like the best thing that ever happened.
Separate topic.
So I rewatched The Warriors last night, and something hit me that never really hit me before about, like, yeah, fuck the band. Right after Cyrus gets all these gangs together and says, we could take over the city, we super outnumber the cops show up, and they don't try to put that into motion. Everyone just scatters. And I think, without actually saying it, I think they're kind of saying, this was a dumb plan.
There is no B to the plan. It's like, get together. It's that old meme, right? Like, you know, team up, step B, TBA, step C, profit.
Well, in their defense, they were hit before they were able to come together and come up with a plan and form any sort of group cohesion. Right now, it's just like, they're not a gigantic gang of hundreds of people. They are, you know, just a bunch of gangs of nine people, all of whom are afraid of the cops.
Yeah. I never knew any straight up gang members, but I was friends with some low life shitheads. And in my experience, low life shitheads are not good at organizing.
Yeah.
No, they're terrible at it.
So it's like, cause if you think about anyone I knew who was associated with gangs sold weed, and, you know, they could barely organize a raid in Guild Wars. let alone get together and plan a coup of the city government. So Cyrus knows what's up. Cyrus is the shit, and the Riffs obviously are the Black Panthers. But I think the rest of the New York City gangs, how are the wannabe Black Panthers going to work with the mimes? Like, what are the mimes going to bring to this? Like, the mime gang.
You entertain us.
He's
trying to tell
again.
Us something. He's trying to tell us something. What? I can't tell.
Pull on that invisible rope.
We had the mime. We had a lookout. It was the mime. Oh, fuck. Oh,
I do wonder how they decide on the outfits. It's like, okay, the Gramercy Riffs, they keep it pretty simple. They go with basically red karate gis. Okay. Yeah. You know, and that's like for the street level guys, and then like the sort of captains, they have like kind of fancier Asian outfits. Okay, fine. But like, Okay, and then the baseball Furies, who I think are like the most iconic thing out of this.
I'm sorry for laughing so much. So yeah, I love
it's a baseball town, New York. We love baseball. Yeah,
they don't even talk. They're just menace.
Yeah.
They're the evil mimes.
Yeah.
Okay, and their thing is carrying baseball bats. All right, so should we wear uniforms? Yeah, I guess. But then, like, their turf isn't even over by Yankee Stadium. It's Riverside Park, which is like...
Let's
and then you got
that
the kind of mime makeup on. Then they get in a big fight, and I'm disappointed that all the Warriors don't have just like paint all over their hands for the rest of the movie from beating on these dudes.
When I was a kid, I loved the Baseball Furies because, you know, and that's like one of the parts where this feels like a video game, right? Because they go, it's like different stages, and that's the base. The first stage is the orphans, and they suck. And then there's the and then the skinheads, the multiracial skinheads, which I like.
Yeah, the Turnbull Aces.
The Turnbull Aces.
They try to run you over with a school bus, and you got to outrun it. And they look like they're having so much fun.
It's kind of a bonus round, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you get the Furies. That's like the first hard stage in the game, right? That's when the game starts cheating, and they have weapons and you don't. It's like when you first see a Bobo in Double Dragon. Like, this is when shit gets real. These guys have makeup on. But as an adult, it's like, this is so fucking stupid. Like, it's great. It's great. It's great. But
because as an adult, you're thinking about, like, okay, they all had to get together and pick out matching outfits and coordinate their face paint. And you just think of, like, the effort that went into appearing like this. And it starts to, the menace goes away.
Yeah.
And it's just like, but you still have baseball bats. So that's something to worry about.
Yeah. You can't put this much effort in your appearance and be a good gang and be a scary gang. Like nobody who's tries that gang members don't try that hard.
Yeah. It's like, and we see a whole bunch of gangs. So it's like, well, they're wearing a satin jacket. I'm like, okay, sure. The Ryan Gosling gang. That's okay. And then, you know, there's another gang I just call it Cuban Dads. They're just all wearing red Hawaiian shirts. They look happy.
If you want a good breakdown of the gangs, go to the Japanese Wikipedia page and translate it. Break down all the gangs. So they list them all. The Rogues, the ACs, the Orphans, the Furies, the Lizzies, the Punks, the Riffs, the Hurricanes, the Boppers, the Hi-Hats, the Eliminators, the Huns, the Moonrunners, the Saccharins, the Mothers, the Jones Street Boys, the... This one is not translated correctly. The Gladiators and the Panzers. So people who have one scene in the movie that they gave them a whole line in the Wikipedia page. So that's good stuff.
Can I just say my favorite gang who appears only in the opening montage, I think, are the guys. I think they've got all suspenders on, and they very politely buy a fistful of tokens and they put the coins in one at a time so they can all go through the turnstile. They're the most polite gang members of all time.
I know. We see a lot of mixed race gangs. I appreciate pretty much every gang is mixed race, but we don't see any co-ed gangs. And that's why the Lizzies are my favorite, because no one sees them coming. Their job is to stand around until guys hit on them, say, oh, come back to our place, and then I'll pull switchblades.
I love that they're called the Lizzies because, like, we can't call them lesbians.
No.
But what's close? Alliteration.
I mean, that's got to be intentional, right?
Yeah,
it's either that or Lizzie Borden, but I think more than likely because they have the two girls who are dancing with each other. I feel like that really cements it.
And they're almost like sirens, like going back to like the whole Greek Roman part. Like they are the temptresses who lure them away. And I like Rembrandt. Okay, people might not know this. I'm gay, so like I get a gay vibe from Rembrandt.
Yeah,
the actor and the character, and I do appreciate that he's the only one who's like, this is not right. Something's wrong here. And then his big tip off is that something's not right. It's like, wait, those two girls are going to kiss. We're in trouble. So I find that really fun. But yeah, that is like the most like Greek part of the movie, I think, like going back to like mythology. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's actually kind of interesting because that part comes right after the group sort of gets split up for the first time. And it's like, so part of the group encounters the Lizzies and they have that whole scene. But that's also what happens to Ajax. Ajax also meets the undercover cop and that becomes the whole thing. So it's like in both cases, when the group gets split apart, they suddenly face temptation from women.
Yeah.
And the women are not what they seem, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but Ajax had it coming, because fuck that dude.
Yeah, he had it coming. She was like, yeah, no, of course we're about to have sex, and he likes it the rough, and he's got to force her. So, yeah, he has it coming 8 ways from Sunday.
So she's a cop, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So here's the thought I don't get about that sting. Like, Ajax isn't wrong. Don't get me wrong. I understand that, okay? But she seems down for consensual acts pretty eagerly. Mm-hmm. So if he would have just been cool, would she have been like, what? Like, because he's a pig and a creep and he gets gross. But yeah. Early on, like, she's like, hey, don't play so rough. And then she stops him. Mm-hmm. So, like, mm-hmm. What's the, did she just know he'd be a piece of shit? Like, what if he wasn't a piece of shit? I don't, what's the question?
Well, maybe she was just going to, like, quietly demur and see if he turned violent then.
Right.
Otherwise, he gets point. To go on his way.
Yeah, I feel like
it's a hell of a sting.
That's not the sting she is actually there to do. I feel like it's purse snatching or getting propositioned as a hooker.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Because I know that used to be an undercover thing that they'd make the lady cops do because they're jerks. Of just like, yeah, go act like a streetwalker for a while. See who tries to pick you up.
I've seen Night Court.
Yeah, exactly. That documentary Night Court.
I mean, she's in a park at night. We don't know what park it is, but she's in a park at night, which
it's, you know, Riverside Park. You see enough landmarks so you can tell it's Riverside Park.
But it's like, that's definitely, you know, it's 1979. If you are alone in a park at night, you are seeking attention. So I feel like it's almost like, speaking of underrated movies, it's almost like Money Train, where, you know, you've got the whole decoy cop thing. I feel like she's one of those decoy cops where, like, she's there and she's not doing anything because she's hoping someone will come up to her and try something, and then she will arrest them because she's got everything right waiting. So it's like he approaches her and she's kind of like, oh, this kid is he's probably trouble, but I'll talk to him and maybe he's not. Maybe he'll make the right choice. And he doesn't make the right choice. And he tries to grab her. Nope. And then she locks him up and the cops are like, because the cops are there in like 10 seconds. Like three cop cars.
They're probably waiting in the bushes.
She's that woman in the cage in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
That's bait. That's
bait.
That's bait.
Oscar winning bait. Thank you.
Oscar. What is when the Oscar for? Fisher King?
Fisher King, yeah.
I never seen that. I gotta watch that.
It's wonderful.
I know.
Very strange movie.
It is very strange, but I rewatched it for 302010, and it's freaking great.
What's that? Majestically cresting the horizon as it makes its way into port. Why, it's the brand new HyperX Armada monitors, mounts, and arms. Both the HyperX Armada 25 and 27 gaming monitors come bundled with a sturdy HyperX Armada mount and arm. If you need every split second of advantage when gaming, the full HD Armada 25 and its 240Hz refresh rate are for you. If you like to soak in the graphical majesty of your gaming, you'll be eyeing the Quad HD Armada 27 with an 165Hz refresh rate. Set sail for HyperX.com or Amazon.com to start making your display Armada.
Quick shout out of other cast folks. I do want to mention, just because of the weird coincidence, so Sonny Landham is one of the cops. He's the guy who gets hit in the leg with a stick. And
no,
I think,
way.
He's,
okay.
think these days he's more famous because he was Billy in Predator.
Mm-hmm.
He was the tracker. He was the, you know, he's a ain't scared of no man. What's out there is no man. Like, that was him.
And he's in 48 Hours.
Oh, yeah. He was probably Walter Hill regular.
Yeah.
And IMDb claims that Steve James and Robert Townsend were in the Baseball Furies.
So do y'all know who Steve James is?
I know who Steve James is. Yes.
So Steve James is my hero. Steve James is in he's in three of the American Ninja films and a few other canon films. He is this massive black dude with an amazing mustache.
Oh, yeah.
Who I have been told makes people, quote, thirsty. And he is a fantastic action actor, completely unfairly forgotten. He passed away kind of young.
Mm.
And I just did a podcast about American Ninja 2, speaking of the classics. And somebody who I was working with in that one, I forgot who, took a screen capture. I'm like, I think that one's Steve James. And there's somebody named Stephen James in the credits. And Steve James lived in the area and he was a stuntman. So it makes sense, but you can't tell which Furies are black.
Right, because they're all painted
it's
up.
It's dark in the face paint, so I have no idea. And the Robert Townsend one, that just confuses the fucking shit out of me.
I feel like that's someone else with that name. He's too wiry. He was a little guy back then.
Yeah. That'd be amazing.
He'd be what, a teenager?
he was in Streets of Fire.
Oh, gosh, you're right. Okay.
So, who knows?
It's possible.
Yeah.
It's possible. I think Steve James is more believable. But, for me, Steve James, I always think of him as the karate guy, and I'm going to get you, sucker.
Yes, he's Kung Fu Joe.
Yeah, Kung Fu Joe.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And he was supposed to be Jax. He was supposed to be Jax in Mortal Kombat, but he passed away. Aww. Like, that was what his son said in an interview. Yeah, Steve James is great. If you want to see good Steve James, American Ninja 1 and 2, and a movie called Avenging Force, which you can just find on YouTube illegally in 1080p, go for it. Good Steve James stuff. Sorry. I am a Steve James stan.
Rightfully so. So, the Warriors, I didn't realize this until watching it again this time. The Warriors are based on a book. So the book is credited to Sol Yurick. This was his first book, and definitely, looking at his list, his most famous book. The book was written in 1965. According to Yurick, it's not my best book. I wrote it as kind of a joke. It took me 3 weeks to write. And I think one of the most important notes is the fact that, you know, being a book about gangs in the city, he had a lot of characters of color, you know, especially, you know, the main gang in the book is all black people. And when it came time to make the movie version, suddenly the studio wasn't okay with that. We have a quote from Walter Hill, and Walter Hill says, Paramount wasn't too high on the idea of an all black cast, as they explained, for commercial reasons. Racism. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll take a drink. Excuse me.
I think it's that sucks shit. But given the controversy that the film had later, it's probably good. Because if it would have been an all-black movie and then had that violence, that would have, the amount of shithead racist bullshit that would have come from this movie would have been terrible.
Yeah.
So
the think pieces that we got about New Jack City glorifying violence.
Yeah.
10 or Boys years in the later. Hood.
Yeah.
Yeah. The idea of, they're saying all, and on the other side, there's, you know, they're saying all black guys are in gangs. Like,
yeah,
no,
exactly.
This gang.
I think you could say like the multiracial makeup of the Warriors kind of works in their favor because, you know, it kind of helps cement, like, because they've overcome any sort of racism and they're all working together. And it's almost an idealized cartoon idea of a gang. It's like Saints Row or something.
and it makes it more of a fantasy.
Yeah,
I think,
yeah, exactly.
Too.
It makes the whole movie, it cements the fantasy a little more.
Yeah.
Or they've gotten past race and it's just about, you know, economics and class warfare.
Because Walter Hill wanted to have this movie set in the future. That was his plan.
Yeah. The funny thing is, I sort of assumed it was set in the future until I think I played the video game and it very clearly establishes it as 1979.
Yeah. Yes. And then that's even more confusing. What year is the game again? 2005?
Yeah, I think
something
so.
Like that, yeah.
Right. Because that's also when the director's cut came out, which actually says it is in the near future.
Yeah, that's a weird, Let's talk about the director's cut. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's a weird director's cut. Because it doesn't do a hell of a lot. But it does put in cartoon interstitials, like we're reading a comic book.
Hmm.
That's a big change. Maybe. And an opening thing about the story by Xenophon. That this is about, you know, the Greeks who had to, the Anabasis, the Greeks who had to fight their way back to their homeland. It's like, well, now I don't feel so smart because you told me.
I held on to my old DVD forever for this because the only Blu-ray for a long time was the director's cut. I did not like it. I don't like the comic book transitions. Like, I know Walter Hill was a big comic book nerd. He wanted to be a comic book illustrator. I get it. But it doesn't fit the... And especially as it done in the director's cut, that obviously computer, it's CG art, and it just takes you out of the movie. And the narration is pointless. Like, he wanted Orson Welles to narrate the movie, which is hilarious, you know. And then he did the narration for the director's cut, I think, and it's just, it doesn't work. There's a new DVD, there's a new Blu-ray box set by Imprint that has both versions, and I will never watch the director's cut. For me, I am ride or die with the original. It just, it doesn't hold a candle. I don't know what version's on streaming.
Rental, it varies.
Yeah, okay.
I ended up with the director's cut, and it was not labeled that way. But I just knew it was like, I don't remember this, and look it up. Oh, well, it's director's cut.
Yeah, the version I saw was the director's cut, and I was very confused by the beginning, because I was like, wait, did I get the wrong, is this the wrong link? What happened? Ancient Greece? Is this 300? No.
Comics, yeah. Comic Sans text in My Warriors? No!
Silent Hill HD all over again. Oh.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, this movie, it was not a big budget movie, but it certainly went over that budget rather quickly.
Well, yeah, they're shooting all on the streets and late at night, sure. But I think I saw there was like one set was built for it.
Yes.
I think the bathroom.
The biggest bathroom ever.
Yeah.
Because you got to have guys roller skating in it. Because that's scary, I guess.
Yeah, almost the entire film was shot in outdoors or underground locations, all in real places in New York City. A lot of the locations were chosen for how they look and not necessarily geographically made sense. I think probably the biggest thing is the opening of the movie is this big scene in the park, and they keep saying it's the name of the park and it's in the Bronx, but they're not shooting in the Bronx. They're shooting in this in a park on the Upper West Side. And right after that, when they escape the park, they run to a cemetery, and the cemetery is in Brooklyn or in Queens somewhere. So it's like, They don't really follow any geography, and if you pay attention and you're from New York, you won't get into it in that sense, but you can still react and still enjoy all the real places they filmed, except for, yes, that one bathroom where they have the big fight scene, because you're not, I mean, at this point, I don't think there's any toilets in the New York City subway. I think there might have been at one time, but even then, you would never find one this big. I mean, it's big enough for what, to have like 20 guys inside, and they're throwing each other into mirrors and smashing stalls. Like, yeah, that's a set. But
I demand authenticity from my public restrooms, damn it.
There are plenty of public restrooms in the New York subway. They're called the cars. Like, from my experience in the New York City subway, Tokyo is very clean, but I will say I lived in Tokyo 8.5 years. I have seen more people pee in train cars here than in New York City. So I don't want to slam New York too much. You know, that's a universal problem.
I did do a bit of a nerdy deep dive into, okay, well, what subway trains are we taking here? And does that make any sense? And there's a blog Scouting New York, which he moved to LA, but he went through every single scene where it's shot. Let's go look at it now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I love seeing the trees grow up. It is so cute. And you're like, oh, that's the same tree. And now it's Geek. But it was kind of driving me nuts because, yes, I did actually pull up a 1979 New York subway map to figure this out and make sure nothing had changed. And the big thing about them saying, we have to get to Union Station or Union Square, that's where we change trains, is like, that doesn't make sense, though. You should be changing at Times Square. What are you talking about?
Yeah, that doesn't quite line up. But you can tell, certainly a lot of the Union Square stuff is in Union Square, which I appreciated, because that's a station I've been to many, many times. Although, in general, a lot of the subway stuff was shot at Hoyt Schermerhorn, I've never said that out loud, which is a really big station in Brooklyn. Apparently had some closed off areas, so it's been used for a lot of productions, and such as Michael Jackson's Bad video was shot there. So, it's a big station. In fact, if you look carefully when you're watching the Warriors, you can see some Hoyt signs on the wall that are either covered up by other names or just completely uncovered. Like, you're not supposed to see them there, but like they missed a few. But but that was like their go-to location because it's so big.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 96th Street, but which 96th Street? Because there's one on the east side of the park, one on the west side of the park, and there is a way where this makes sense, honestly. If they were taking the train, if they got out of Woodlawn Cemetery and they took the train to Union Station, then they would change trains there, and that actually makes sense, except it doesn't make sense because they leave the station and get chased by the Baseball Furies into Riverside Park, which is on the other side of town, and I nerded out way too much about the geography. I really spent time on it. It's like, it's so close to being perfect, though.
We'll be right back. You know, I live in Pittsburgh, and, you know, when I watched Zach and Mary Make a Porno, a great film, the geography does not make sense here, but, you know, that matters to me, not to the general viewing public who just didn't watch the movie in the first place. But, you know, I think the filmmakers are probably more concerned about not getting killed with everything else going on, because Diamond, I guess that they had issues making this movie.
Yeah, well, part of it is tied just to the fact that what was New York like? New York in the 70s was having some troubles, having some serious, serious troubles.
Filthy and dangerous.
I know from headlines the president told them to drop dead.
Yeah, that was, I think, 78. So I did some, I found out some stats. So according to FBI statistics, during the 70s, New York City averaged over 146 violent felonies per year. And that was number one of all states. Like, that's, I mean, New York City, but statewide, because let's face it, New York City kind of stands for New York State as a whole. New York State as a whole ranked number one in violent crime and robberies throughout the 70s and for a good chunk of the 80s. Good chunk of the 80s,
number
too.
Number one.
It's all Buffalo, though. That's the secret you don't know about.
It's too cold. It's too cold to be to do crimes in Buffalo.
This is true.
And just for contrast purpose, for the last 10 years, which of course, you know, the last 10 years is a much larger New York City. Many millions more people live in New York City now than they did 40 or 50 years ago. They only had half as many violent crimes. So it's a stark contrast. And especially the subway itself was also especially bad. We have a quote here, and it's September 1979, just over 250 felonies per week were recorded in the subway. Far above any other mass transit network anywhere in the world. So
it reminds me of that old, there's an old SCTV skit where someone says, in New York, a man is mugged every 12 seconds. This is that man. There was a whole vigilante group, not that's the Guardian Angels, another one who picketed this movie later, and their main thing was staying on the subways to find people to stop muggers. Because it was such a big problem.
Well, yes, I mean, yeah. We have the quote. You have the quote there from Curtis Sliwa. That was the guy who eventually his group eventually became the Guardian Angels.
The Magnificent 13 became the Angels. That's that guy.
Yeah,
oh, I didn't know
Curtis Sliwa. He was the Guardian Angels guy.
Is he the shitty one who ran for office recently?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Not
so
a great.
Yeah, he kind of sucks.
Not a great guy. I'm just saying that's the guy. Not a great guy, but that's him.
Yeah.
He's great. I want to read his quote on the Warriors. It's like he said this movie was violence from front to end, lacking a plot. I wish, because I would watch the shit out of that. You know, whenever you get a moral outrage from a movie, and this was more justified in some ways, but whenever you get a moral outrage, the movie that they're describing always sounds way cooler than the actual movie. But it's so violent. You're saying, Diamond, and then that translated to like gang problems when they were making the movie, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're filming real shots on the street, so they had to deal with real gangs as well. And, you know, depending on which story you read, they were either paying off gangs or the gangs were harassing them, or maybe column A and column B. Like, it was a mess, but they
were urinating on them.
Yeah. Cause they're shooting in New York City. They're shooting at night, and they had some, I guess for the big park scene, they probably had some extras who were probably real gang members. And then it's like, who gets to be on camera, who doesn't. Then you got fights on that respect. It's just this incredibly difficult shoot. I have a great quote here from one of the actors who said they were going to shoot a scene on Avenue A. And I should stress right now. So Avenue A is a neighborhood called Alphabet City, because you got Avenue A, B, C, D. It's like the Lower East Side. And, you know, I'm sure it's fine today, but in the 70s, that was like a really bad neighborhood. And the quote is from the actors, like, they had to cancel a scene because there was a double homicide up the block.
Oh, jeez.
Well, the real gang in Coney Island at the time was called the Homicides. Like, that's, like, calm down. My favorite gang story about the movie is that they hired an NYPD gang advisor, like an expert. And they went to him, and they're like, the gangs want us to pay him off so we can film. And he's like, well, you should do that then. You should probably pay them. Because it's just, because the gangs want Trump, they want $500. You know, it's like, it's Paramount Pictures. Like, just pay the gang. It's just easier to pay the gang.
It's not worth the trouble if you don't pay them. And then, you know, they can work as security. That always works out great. It's always a great idea. You know, just ask the Rolling Stones.
They had gang members were stealing stuff on the set. So they had an idea to get the costumes back. They had a raffle. And you bring your costume back with a ticket and you could win a prize. But then people were mugging the winners. So they had to quit. Good shit.
It's kind of funny because like the warriors themselves they're not quite heroic, but they seem more like vigilantes than criminals. Like you never really see them committing crimes. They're really just more about like, yeah, we're a real heavy set. We'll take on all comers. And
yeah, it's a good question. What is the worst crime they commit in the movie? They jump turnstiles several times. Oh,
okay, yeah.
Oh, no. They jump the turnstiles more than once.
I feel like the movie's portrayal of gangs is kind of a 1950s, 1960s, like a little bit of like, they're just tough kids who want to hang out together and
maybe hang out and rumble
and pick a fight and maybe steal some shit. Like, drug dealing is not in the equation here.
You know,
sex trafficking is not in the equation here. Well, you know what I mean? Like nothing.
They carry one Molotov cocktail just in case.
No guns.
No.
Yeah.
Yep. They have the emergency Molotov cocktail that they can just throw at the orphans. And now all the orphans are dead, I guess.
Gotta have your EMC. Yes, you're right.
Yeah. The orphans are the worst. I feel so bad for them after this viewing. It's like, I always made fun of them because, like, you're all dressed like Shaggy from Scooby-Doo and you suck.
The orphans suck.
I didn't realize, their problem is low self-esteem. When they're, like, lying. The warriors are lying to him, like, oh, yeah, our social worker totally told us about how tough you are. He's like, yeah? we don't have a social worker, are we?
That's because you're so bad.
Oh yeah, because they're so scared of the orphans. They're so sad. I don't understand why Mercy is not in charge of them. Like, why is she just showing up to goad them? Like, hey, do something. Fight for my amusement.
Mention her too.
Hmm. Yeah, like the only female character, frankly,
Deborah Van Valkenburg, Mercy. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, what is your deal? And like, there's a point where she's like, okay, well, I guess I'm with the warriors now because they beat up the orphans, so I'm with them. And they're like, why? And she's like, eh. And then she disappears for a little bit and then comes back and is like, I'm with you guys now, I guess.
Well, and I think,
even though they've repeatedly threatened her,
I think she's kind of like Marty McFly's mom. Like, she's kind of a danger. Like, what? I don't, that's not a nice way to say that. Like, guys can be this too. She's a danger slut. She's just like, she goads the orphans to fight, you know, because she's looking for action.
Yeah.
And she gets off on the intense. And when she has to throw down later, she throws down. She bites that dude in the damn neck. Yeah. Mercy, vampire killer. Yeah, she's great. She's also in Streets of Fire. I like her a lot. She didn't get enough good work. Deborah Van Valkenburg. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a much better character than I guess it was in the book where a bad thing is done to her by our gang halfway through the movie or book, she's just gone. That's it.
Oh, dear.
It's a cautionary tale of don't get involved with the gang because then they will all assault you and then you're not a character anymore.
Ugh.
Ugh.
Yeah, they are definitely much more heroic in the movie than in the book. When you need me, call my name in the day or night.
I'm Colette.
And I'm Matt.
It's time to talk about the most important topic facing humanity.
Climate video games. Change. Oh, okay, video games.
Every week on Colette and Matt Have Entered the Chat, we have in-depth conversations about the games we're currently playing.
We also talk to people who make video games, as well as YouTubers, writers, and podcasters that you already know and love.
We also talk about what you're playing when you join our community.
Subscribe to Colette and Matt Have Entered the Chat wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I think there's an interesting contrast. So you've got this, the movie opens with this big meeting, and the implication that I get from the meeting is that people were told to show up with 9 people and no weapons. Like, this is a meeting, this is a specific meeting for a certain number of gangs and a certain number of people per gang. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you get the impression that the warriors just all showed up. Cause like, other gangs seem to have, you know, backup or, so like the orphans, you see some orphans and then one orphan runs away. It's like, oh, he's going to get more orphans. And
warfins,
but the warriors just seem like that's all of them. I don't think they have any backup. I think they just all show up and that's it.
There are deleted scenes that do show that. Okay. Leon, the warlord, picked these guys to come with him.
Okay.
So like in there is the idea that there are more of them, but it is strange that they go back to Coney Island and no one's there for them.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Like when they get home and it's like, okay, we're home at last. We have no backup, and we're still in danger.
Yeah. Yes.
Yep. Well, it's like 5 a.m. and they don't have cell phones. All the other warriors are asleep, one presumes.
Yeah. Yes. And it's been a really long night. I just learned, literally right before we recorded, of the Ultra Run, the Warriors Ultra Run.
Yes.
I kind of want to go check this out now, but only the beginning or the end. I don't actually want to watch people running, where they have... The people run the route. It's 28 miles and there's a group of 9 and they get a head start and then everyone runs after them and they got to run all the way to Coney Island and they start at 1 in the morning and they don't shut down the streets. It's an underground thing.
I'd be deader than shit. Like either my heart or I'd be stabbed. One of the two. Like there's
Well, it's just over a marathon, you know?
Oh, and God.
Yeah. Usually it's running about 4 hours by like people who know what they're doing. And it's like, I do want to see the beginning of that race of everyone getting together in their costumes and then, okay, go. In the middle of the night. Fuck. But were there more gang members in the video game? Or is that it?
You see them.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't think you don't like, there aren't more like original warriors that were made just for the game, don't think.
Okay.
You see a lot more of the other gang members, and they're kind of given more personality and individual treatment. But
yeah, we were playing the game, or Michael was playing and I was watching because I suck at games. And I did find it pretty interesting that you think most games, it's like, here's what happened after the movie. And that this is almost all, here's what leads up to the movie. And then here is the movie. And then that's it. You're done.
Yeah.
You're not just playing the movie and you're not playing a fake sequel. You're playing a fake prequel plus the movie itself.
Yeah.
Because just the movie isn't long enough.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think it's really funny that the game establishes that the Warriors are only one of the gangs in Coney Island. So it's like there's East Coney Island and West Coney Island. Because like, to me, Coney Island is not that big a territory. So it's like, in the movie, it's like, oh, we hang out in Coney Island, which, you know, it's geography-wise, this lines up. That is the end of the line. Like, when they get that train, that's the end of the line. Coney Island's the last stop.
Mm-hmm.
So... it makes sense to me that there would just be a gang that hangs out in Coney Island and, like, you know, when they're not riding the cyclone, they, you know, they beat people up and they wear the little vests and, like, that's their thing. But in the game, it's like, oh, we are on, you know, we're East Coney Island. The Destroyers are West Coney Island. We hate them. It kind of undercuts them a little bit.
Yeah, the Warriors are like a splinter group from the Destroyers who are now taking over. They're on the rise and the Destroyers are on the decline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it feels like, yeah.
Let's go steal car radios.
I mean, that's made explicit. There are flashback missions where you play as Cleon and Vermin as members of the Destroyers, and then they get betrayed and, like, we're going to start our own gang.
Yeah, and we're not going to wear shirts. Mm. What do they wear in the winter?
That's how tough they are.
Yeah. This all takes place in January. No one said anything.
Layer on more vests.
They can cut people with their nipples. It's great. Did you want to talk about, before we go to the game too much, did you want to talk about what happened when the movie came out?
Yeah, we can talk about the reception because it was a hit movie. This was a hit.
Yeah.
It opened in a crowded, I mean, granted, I couldn't, you know, it's hard to find exact release information and weekend breakdowns from 1979, but the word is from all the quotes that it opened on a very busy, crowded weekend. I mean, it's February, so like not a busy time for movies, but also like it opened against a lot of the movies, and it opened at number one, so it was a hit.
Yeah, it beat Superman. Yes, and it ended up grossing about $22 million, and which makes it the 17th, according to Box Office Mojo, that's the 17th highest grossing major film of the year. So, to give you an idea of where it was, it beat Life of Brian, it beat Animal House, it beat Normal Ray. It got beat by The Rose. It got beat by 1941.
oh my God!
Manhattan and all that jazz. The highest grossing film of that year was Superman, which made $93 million that year and $134 million total. So, you know, only a fraction of that, but it was it's opened strong. It got mixed but good reviews. And Janet Maslin and Pauline Kael both loved this movie, like
wow,
hugely loved it. But had a problems, and can I talk about that a bit?
Please.
Is that okay to bring that up now?
You found this data. Give it to us.
So whenever you hear about The Warriors now, you hear like, oh, it had to get pulled from theaters because of violence. And that's always what I read on Wikipedia, and they say people died and stuff. And I'm like, I wanted to find out what really happened. So I dug through the newspaper archives to dig in the actual details. So there were three major incidents. Two happened on February 12th. One happened a week later. In Oxnard, California, there was a, quote, racial altercation in the lobby, and an 18-year-old kid was stabbed to death.
Oof.
I don't know. I know the stabbers saw the movie. I don't know if the stabbee did. Sorry to make light of it. But yes, then on the same day in Palm Springs at a drive-in, a 19-year-old was shot in the head.
Oh, geez.
That killer only got 4 years. He got from voluntary manslaughter. I imagine what happened was the other person started it too. So, and also the laws for that were way more lenient back then.
I guess. Yeah.
And then a week later on the 18th, some kids who saw the movie stabbed somebody in the subway and he died. He was 16 years old. He was not in a gang, but he knew them because it was, I think, like a neighborhood thing. And then for the first one, the family of the first victim sued the filmmakers and the MPAA. I don't believe that ever went to court. I couldn't find anything about that. If it did, they settled it and set it up. But like, people were really surprised by this. And a lot of theaters pulled the movie. Paramount paid to have more security at some screenings. Most theaters said there wasn't a problem. Some theaters were like, I wish no one's coming to see this goddamn movie. Other ones were like, well, we've had some vandalism and some kids fighting, but not a big deal. I like what Walter Hill's reaction was. Basically, he's like, I'm not saying terrible things didn't happen, but at one point you have to say, so what? Are you going to make films for the least responsible members of the audience? What are you going to, like, you know, he can't make a movie to, you can't police yourself when you make a movie. And I feel like that's a good viewpoint on it. Eventually they did pull the movie. They pulled the ads. They redid the ads to take out all the lines about gang members. And they put out ads. Like, one of the ads was just Pauline Kael's review. Like, her entire, Pauline Kael was a major film critic in New York in the 70s.
And incredibly persnickety. And yeah, I'm kind of surprised that she would like this, because
she loved this movie.
A lot of times she would just think like, oh, violence is just such a cheap way to get a reaction out of an audience. What happened to storytelling?
It was the style of it got to her. And a lot of the critics who loved it, and even the ones who didn't like it, like Ebert, liked the style and appreciated the minimal script. Like Walter Hill, he didn't write it, but when it was finished, he cut the shit out of the script to make it the dialogue as lean as possible. Like, there are scenes that have no dialogue, and that's kind of his thing. So they brought the movie back, but it couldn't recapture the momentum it had before. And so it didn't get a full theatrical run. But even with its only minor run, it was still a hit. But I do think it's crazy that you hear these stories about like people actually dying from this move because of this movie. And like you heard that later on with Boys in the Herd. I remember that one. And I remember in Pittsburgh, someone was murdered in the lobby during that 50 Cent movie.
Get Rich or Die Trying?
Yes. In Pittsburgh, we called it Get Popcorn or Die Trying. But so like, and sometimes you wonder, okay, is this just moral panic because these movies have black casts? Like, I'm sure there are movies of white casts, so people fight in the parking lot and shit, but no, it doesn't make the news.
Yeah. No, that happened with, Boys in the Hood and New Jack City both had, you know, fights in parking lots afterwards, and they made such a big deal. And it's like, have you watched either of these movies? They are not condoning violence or encouraging it at all.
Especially Boys in the Hood. Jesus Christ.
Come on.
Yeah. So it's a moral
panic. Kramer versus Kramer. Three couples got divorced right there in the lobby.
My parents got divorced not too soon after that movie. God damn you, Dustin Hoffman. I knew it.
Citizens divorce.
Every time. Yeah, it is. You know, it's a sad. People died. It is sad. But you can't blame a movie for that. Like, it's just people suck. And sometimes sucky people do shitty things. And as is life, you know,
shitty people go to the movies too.
Exactly.
And they get into fights.
Yeah. And no one sued after all of the singing and dancing in the parking lot after all that jazz.
I wish. No one sued after roller skate accidents in Xanadu.
Should have.
R.I.P. Yes. Also, you know, Swan is in Xanadu, which I always, whenever I watch this movie, I'm like, you're in Xanadu.
Yeah, and those roller skating guys show up, and you're like, you know how to deal with this.
Yeah. Come on. But it's just one of those things like, a movie about gangs is going to attract more gang members to watch it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, if they made a movie about English teachers in Tokyo, I'd watch shit out of that. But you can't blame the movie for the people sucking. I think, you know, no matter what that guy from the Guardian Angels wants you to believe. So, yeah.
So we've had a long chat about the movie itself at this point. Let's get into the legacy and the adaptations of this movie, because there were, in fact, two video games. We should mention, just matter-of-factly, in 2009, The Warriors Street Brawl, which is just an ugly-as-sin beat-em-up that was released for a downloadable market. It's 2009, you know, everyone's got to make a downloadable game at this point, so it was on Xbox Live, it was on Windows, you can watch it on YouTube, it looks like ass. It's just the ugliest piece of crap you've ever seen.
Yeah.
Much more notable, I think, is The Warriors from 2005, which was a Rockstar's published this, and I think Rockstar Toronto developed it.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same as the Grand Theft Auto people, but certainly in the same corporate umbrella.
House's name's on it. House's name is on that game. Like, it is a Rockstar game. That game's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the thing is, like, yeah, if you wanted something like the Street Brawl game, there is like a retro style beat 'em up within the Warriors full size 2005 game that you can, I think you unlock it as an extra, and it's like an arcade game in the Warriors hideout, and you just go up and play it, and it's like a loose adaptation of the events of the movie. And I think at the end, the ghosts of Cleon and Cyrus fight each other. It's pretty great.
I forgot about that. I played through the first part of it recently, and I like how they recreate the opening of the movie, you know, and then it flashes back to like Rembrandt joining, and they got as much of the cast as they could to do more dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, like the actor played Rembrandt passed away, so he's not there. And a few others are recast. They sound a little bit older, obviously, but it's just, you don't see video game movies. You don't see games based on movies that often that one are based on a movie that's like at this point, 26 years old. And when it came out, and two, it obviously is made by people who love the shit out of that movie, and they want to do it justice.
Yeah, well, this wasn't the first time Rockstar did that with an old movie. Like, they had a PS1 adaptation of The Italian Job, like the original Michael Caine Italian Job.
Yes! Right.
And it was fantastic.
I told you, just a bloody doze off!
It released as, like, a budget game, and this was when they were sort of transitioning from, like, an oddball budget publisher to, like, you know, it was leading up to Grand Theft Auto 3, which was like their big watershed moment of like, oh, they're actually serious artists and, you know, a big force in the games industry. And it's really interesting that they approached it like this very old movie and like with a lot of love, love for it.
And they use so much of it. And I think you can download it for PS4, or PS5.
Yes, but it does not work well on PS5. I'll say that.
Okay.
PS4, it works great.
And they took out some music. So if you're going to, it doesn't have In the City by Joe Walsh at the end.
Mm.
And almost as important, it doesn't have I Love Living in the City by Fear, which is, I didn't play the game to completion recently, but I remember very clearly I Love Living in the City is playing when you're fighting the Turnbell ACs. Mm. And that is such great music to get to scene like combination, because I Love Living in the City is about how much New York sucks shit, and like it's like, you know, my house is full of soot and puke. I think my cockroaches on all my balls, you know. It's like you're fighting this dirt ball gang. It's a perfect combination. So like, you know, there are other ways to play that game in 2022.
You can get your hands on the PS2 version, by all means. Play that instead.
If there are some magical ways to find that version, then I would recommend doing that.
I tried, honestly. I was just on vacation recently, and I went to a few retro game shops, and I looked for the Warriors, and stores had it, but it was actually quite pricey because I guess it's got a good reputation.
Yeah.
So even an opened used copy was significant money.
It still plays pretty good. Yeah.
The PS4 version is a little bit janky. Like, I feel like, did the controller get more sensitive or something? Because, like, the camera is kind of wonky. And, yeah, there are some things that have aged poorly that have nothing to do with gameplay. Like, James Remar says the F-slur right there in the intro. I don't feel like a game would do that now.
I want to talk. Oh, there's two of them about the game I want to talk about really quick. One is that, you know, they got all the cast as they could, but they did not get Cyrus. Roger Hill, and he sued them.
Yeah,
and but then he passed away. So I think
I wonder why they didn't get him. Maybe he was asking for too much money. I wonder.
Yeah, I don't know. But you bring up the part in the beginning. So like, there's a phrase that Ajax uses quite a bit.
Yeah.
Should we not say it at all? I can. I mean, I don't mind saying it. Do we not to say it?
I like sticking with F slur because it's not the F word. It's the one that's a slur that we don't say.
He accuses people of turning F blank. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm happy they left it in the game because Ajax sucks.
That's true.
And you don't. Yeah, he's the kind of guy. Ajax is the kind of guy that, look, if you're going to be in a fight and he's there, you want him on your side.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And what's a really shorthand way of someone's a piece of shit? I know. And then, yeah, maybe that's lazy. Lazy writing in 2022, but like, if you take that part out, that's the character. That character is a hypermasculine shithead.
That's a good point. And the first time he shows up in the story, he is getting rough with a girl.
Yeah, in the game.
Yeah.
And in the movie, he's the only one who throws slurs around. I don't think anyone else ever says something about that. So
no. Yeah. And I also just love that slur, like the idea of that, even like that's such a funny phrase, like turning that, like this, oh no, I woke up and oh no, yeah.
I'm not all the way there, but I'm turning.
Decided I was going to go F slur today.
Yeah, just a
mood thing.
So no, I'm glad
I'm 60% there. Oh no.
Yeah. So I'm glad they left it in the game, and I. Yeah, if you would have made it now, maybe you wouldn't do that. But it doesn't bother me because, again, fuck that dude.
So, fair enough.
Hey, not a slur that applies to me, so I guess I don't get to complain. I don't know.
I think it's interesting. One of the interesting changes, I think, is, you know, we talked about earlier how the Warriors are sort of in the movie somewhat heroic in that they're sort of on the run. You don't really see them doing much of anything actually sinister. Whereas the game is like, oh no, yeah, we mug people, we rob people, we steal things from cars. Like, that's how we make money. We buy drugs, we sell drugs.
it was kind of a shock, honestly, because I was used to that characterization from the movie. And it's like, oh, no, yeah, I guess they would commit crimes and steal car stereos in a great minigame that is one of the most memorable things about it.
Tagging shit. Like, but, okay, yeah. I understand,
like,
that.
Oh,
that
you're banged up? Go buy some flash from this dealer, and then you'd, like, pop it like an amyl nitrate cap or something.
Yeah, that is the Rockstar drug use, right? In Rockstar games, drugs make you happy.
I mean, exactly. It reflects the era. This is, you know, this is 2005, so, like, we're very much riding the high of the Grand Theft Auto 3 explosion. So I feel like every publisher, every studio is trying to get in on that. They're trying to go open world. They're trying to go gritty. I mean, I feel like this is the same era, like, you had the Scarface video game, which was all about balls and... what was it? Midway brought back Narc?
About what, Diamond?
Balls.
Okay.
Yeah.
Balls.
And Midway brought back Narc, and it was like an edgy yeah. Narc where you had to take the drugs to, like, do your job, but you couldn't do too much.
Bill Bellamy's Narc.
So terrible.
Yeah. So I just think that was just, that's the style of the time, you know, like, everyone had to be doing drugs and committing crimes in the game, or it wasn't cool. Mm.
I'm bummed that you will never see a studio of Rockstar's caliber make a game like this ever again, because there's no money in it. Like, a AAA studio is not going to spend the money needed to make a AAA video game based on an old property they do not own.
Yeah.
Mm.
Unless it's Marvel or DC or something, or Star Wars.
Where's the long tail? Where's the live game experience?
Mm. Yeah, there's no live game experience. There's no microtransactions. Like, you know, when I complain about microtransactions in games and, like, online services games, this is one of the reasons why. It's because so much effort and time and money is put into those games that games like The Warriors, there's just no need for these studios to make those games. So then the only smaller studios can, and they can do a good job, but they don't have the resources to really go hog wild and really, like, hey, let's get the cast to do the voice acting again. You know, that's the only major studio can do that. And so, you know, we're never going to get a great, you know, Taking a Pelham 1-2-3 video game in my imagination, or I don't know, any of the other old good Basket Case. They'll go back to Basket Case, you know. Any old movie that could make a good video game, it's just the odds of it happening are pretty slim.
Yeah, I'd still love to see someone do, like, a Death Race 2000 that, like, mods the Crew 2's entire USA as, like, one big racetrack.
I thought you were going to say Death Wish for a second. I'm like, oh, no.
not a Death Wish game. Oh, the one with David Carradine. It's Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And Stallone.
Yeah, you can make that a live service game. And I got dibs on Mary Warnoff. And my whole life in the city where junk is king and the air smells shitty.
Well, we've had a long conversation about the Warriors, almost as long as the Warriors film itself. So I feel like we can probably wrap things up here. Does anyone have any last points or last things they want to share about the Warriors that you feel like is really important?
I think it is quaint and adorable how few guns there are. And I mean, they set up, obviously don't bring guns to the meeting, and that's why most people don't have guns on them. But... still, and then what do they have? They got, like, Saturday Night Specials. They got, like, little
Luther has a gun, and this is treated like a big deal.
Yeah. And the fact that...
And it's not 1950s West Side Story. It's 1979. You could probably buy a gun from a vending machine.
Yeah. But then, like, most people's weapon is a switchblade.
Yeah.
And I love that the orphans have to, like, run off and go get them. It's like, the point is that they're portable. That's why people like switchblades. So, yeah, that sort of 50s quaint gang idea of, like, that guy's got a chain. That's the most dangerous thing in town. He's got the board with a nail in it.
Look out for that guy. He's got a bigger board with a bigger nail.
But then how video game is that? You know, like, you're playing a video game. You face most people who are unarmed. It's like, oh, this guy has a knife. He's dangerous. This guy's got the Molotov cocktail. He's dangerous.
Yeah. He must be the boss of this level, waiting for you to throw that Molotov cocktail. Okay.
That's another thing about the game. Like, I run into so many things where it's just like, Oh, I threw someone into this store display and it was full of Molotov cocktails and now it exploded and we're both on fire. That happened like 3 or 4 times.
Oh, goddamn it.
I love the game mechanic of like, here's how you jump through a plate glass window.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Just jump straight through it. It's fine. Trust me.
Fine, yeah. The one thing I want to add isn't so much about the Warriors as more just, if you do like the Warriors, watch more Walter Hill films.
Yeah.
Watch Streets of Fire as one of the most brilliantly bizarre batshit movies you'll ever see in your entire life. Obviously, watch 48 Hours. There's a lesser known film named called Southern Comfort, which is kind of like Bayou Billy.
So, oh, wow.
With Keith Carradine, everyone's favorite Carradine, Fred Ward and Powers Booth, which is like National Guardsmen fighting hillbillies in Louisiana. And I like that movie, but no one else has ever seen it.
And, I've seen it. I like it.
Oh, yay. And there's one more, like Walter Hill's more recent films have been not so good. He has a new one coming out called Dead for a Dollar with Christoph Waltz and Willem Dafoe in it. So who knows? In 2012, he made a movie called Bullet to the Head with Stallone and Sun Kang. That's Han from Fast and Furious.
Right.
And Han is an FBI agent, and Stallone is a hitman, and they have to team up to fight bad guys. It's not great. Kristen Slade is fantastic in it, though, as a drug-dealing, sleazy politician. And it's really uneven. It's kind of stupid. But if you want to see Sylvester Stallone get into an axe fight with Jason Momoa, it's not a great film. It's not a great film. It has, like, 25 producers. It's kind of a mess. But you could do a lot worse ways than 91 minutes. And it has those glimpses of Walter Hill like style that it's get drunk and watch it. You'll like it.
All right.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Actually, speaking of Walter Hill, I think on 302010, I believe we had an Undisputed coming up in 2002, turning 20 years old.
Oh, okay. I never seen that. I know it has sequels.
Yeah, which always makes me a little dubious.
It's a prison boxing movie?
Yeah, with Wesley Snipes, which I'm going to go watch shortly.
The sequels have Scott Atkins,
okay.
Who is like a great B movie. He's a big B movie martial artist.
Right.
He's like the 21st century Chuck Norris. So I have to watch those. But anyway, sorry.
Yep. So yeah, no, Walter Hill's still chugging along. Bless him.
Well, this has been Retronauts. So thank you for listening, everybody. I'm really, really glad you tuned in for this one. I think we had a great chat. Thank you everyone for joining us. Let's go around and talk about things we do outside of Retronauts. So let's start with you, James. Let's go ahead and tell us about your podcast again that I've been on several times.
Yes, Diamond has been on one of my other podcasts, Cinema Oblivia, which is a podcast with me and a kind of rotating other people where I talk about old movies that are a little more obscure, hard to find, or just not talked about that much anymore. Recent episodes have been about Car Wash, American Ninja 2, Thrashin', Psycho 2, Alligator, and I've had Diamond on there, lots of other great guests, Brian, how do you say his last name, Ashcraft? Brian Ashcraft from Kotaku has been on a couple times to talk about Walter Hill movies. So if you like old movies, check that out at Cinema Oblivia. I'm also on a podcast about progressive rock music called Alexander's Ragtime Band. That's with my friend Elliot, and Jeremy's there sometimes. Jeremy Paris is there sometimes as well. And we do that once a month. And my podcast, Oblivia, Cinema Oblivia, is every other week. And I'm also on Twitter, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, pretty much everything as Lost Turntable.
You know, Jeremy, James.
Nope.
I was thinking, watching this movie, I was thinking of your podcast because in the subway, when they're running away, they run past a Foul Play poster. This the Chevy Chase, Goldie Hawn movie. And I'm telling you, that is prime material for your podcast. That's a movie that was a big deal, and then it just was forgotten.
Well, I bought that because you recommended it, and I haven't watched it yet because I'm an idiot. So I've been too busy watching Amityville films to get into that. So yeah, we watched one with a lamp last night. Good sir. Anyway, that's definitely coming soon to Cinema Oblivia, me and Diamond talking about Foul Play.
All right. Sure. Excellent.
Yeah.
Michael, why don't you tell us about the VGM, VGA?
VGA, yes. Vigigame Apocalypse is a weekly show. We are out every Friday at vigigameapocalypse.com or on the podcast app of your choice. We begin every show with a top 5 around some random video game themed topic. And then we talk about new releases, news that week. We have a community segment where we ask people questions and they answer them. It's a fun time. And you can also find me on Twitter at Wikiparaz. That's WIKIPARAZ, where I will occasionally say funny things.
You usually say funny things.
Yeah, occasionally because I don't post very often.
Diana, please.
All right. And you can hear me every single week on 302010. Follow me on Twitter at ListenANerd, LECINENERD, or the show 302010 podcast. We come out every single week looking at the movies, TV, and music of that same week, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago. And we got some good stuff coming up. I don't know when this is going to post, but let's see. Recently, we've talked about everything from Unforgiven to Adventures of Pluto Nash.
I enjoyed your discussion on Mom and Dad Save the World because somebody has to, and I'm not doing that. So I'm glad
somebody,
you did.
Yeah, we end up finding weird stuff. I think coming up, we have the 30th anniversary of the first important director's cut, honestly.
Ooh.
Blade Runner?
Blade Runner, bitches.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And then beyond that, oh gosh, we got singles coming up because I'm so goddamn old. And that's the worst thing is I was a teenager watching all these. And then by the time we got to October, we have just in 1 week, Reservoir Dogs, The Transporter, and Argo. I love when things happen like that.
Reservoir Dogs, another film I got to watch because of my dad. Thanks, Dad.
Great. Thanks, this Dad. Is okay.
You're 13. You can watch this. It's fine.
What's he doing in that guy's ear?
I should say on Video Game Apocalypse, we're just wrapped up an episode where we talk about obscure and underappreciated light gun games with special guest Dan Amrick, formerly of GamePro, currently of Digital Eclipse, working on games like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Cowabunga collection. So it's a fun, what, like 3 hours? I think it's a long ass show. The top five is much shorter.
Both of our shows run way too long because we end up digging into things just too dang much. Mm-hmm. Like I'm sorry. Yeah, after talking about Mom and Dad Save the World, we ended up spending, oh God, it felt like a million years talking about Stay Tuned starring John Ritter. And then,
I love that movie.
Oh, look, we have to talk about the Larry Sanders Show. Well, there goes an hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a Stay Tuned fan, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that ended up being a light recommend because, like, well, anyone who saw this as a kid, it's going to, they'll be like, oh my God, I knew that movie existed. It's been bugging me for years. What was the movie where they get trapped in the TV and they go to hell?
Yeah. That's why I did an episode about a movie called Big Shots last month, because like I saw that as a kid and everyone else was like, I kind of know that one. It's real, right? It wasn't a fever dream.
Yep. I love hearing from people when that happens. So follow the show or whatever. We'll awaken strange memories. That's what we do.
Speaking of strange memories, this has been Retronauts. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow the show. We have Retronauts.com. We have Retronauts Twitter. You can also support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/Retronauts. For $3 a month, you get episodes 1 week in advance at a higher bitrate. For $5 a month, that's just $2 more. That's nothing. That's barely anything. You get two bonus episodes every month. Those are exclusives. And you get weekly columns from me, and I read the columns to you. That's a deal. That's a bargain.
Ooh.
In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Twitch, Fight Club, F-E-I-T, that's my last name, C-L-U-B, that's a gathering of people or a blunt instrument. And yeah, so before we finish, real quick, everyone, on the spot. So what's your Warriors gang? James, go.
Oh no. I'm not good at this.
No.
I just want to make self-deprecating gay jokes and I can't, so I'm going to pass.
Okay. Michael?
Is this we're making up a gang or
yeah.
Oh, all right. The Bookworms. I don't know.
Bookworms? Okay.
Diana. I got one.
Okay. Oh. Go ahead.
Go for it.
The ego senseis.
Nice.
That's English teachers. When we wear suits and we look really tired. That's our thing.
Feel like mine wasn't as well developed.
And we correct everyone's pronunciation. That's all we do. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My gang would be the Madame du Pompadours. We all dress as 18th century French noblewomen. And that means we can never actually get out onto the street because our outfits and wigs are way too complicated.
Excellent.
My gang, too.
We're the Neo Geos. We all dress like Terry Bogard with that cap.
And you cost $400 a pop.
Oh, man.
We do.
Well, I want to join that gang. Well, I was just gonna say the Dollar Slice kids. So we always hang out at the Dollar Slice pizzerias, and we eat a lot of pizza. And don't take our pizza, or we'll smash you with the can of soda that comes with the pizza. All right. Can you dig it?